Hey there, folks and music nerds, welcome back. This is episode number 140 and the final episode of season 6. My guest today is the mighty Jerry Douglas, and I'm very excited to bring you that conversation. I'm jumping in here right at the beginning instead of the regular show intro because we have some stuff to take care of and I thought we'd get right into the action. First of all, I just wanted to thank everyone so much for tuning in this whole season. If you're a new listener, welcome. And if you've been with me for a few years now, thanks for sticking around. It's been a great season. I've had a blast putting it all together. I've had some great conversations and learned a ton about all kinds of crazy stuff. If you're new to the show, make sure you peruse some of the back episodes and get a load of the previous show's guests. There's lots of good stuff back there. So first of all, I wanted to mention that season 7 is coming. I've started on it. I've already had a few people over to the hen house to do some yakking. I've got a few under my belt. So I don't have a firm schedule yet, but I'm kind of thinking that I'll start dropping the new episodes in May of this year. So a couple months from now, the plan would be for them to run through the end of 2023 and maybe wrap up around then completely that next season. I don't know. We'll see. That's the loose plan anyway. So probably a couple months of no episodes, and then in May we'll start up again. I will keep you posted. So there's a few ways this show stays on its feet, and that's basically through sponsors and you guys, the listeners. Costs keep going up to host a website, host the podcast, maintain all that stuff, do the editing, booking, and finalizing of each episode. It always seems to stay afloat somehow, and I'd like to thank you all for kicking in wherever you've done that. It's greatly appreciated. The sponsors have been amazing this year. I'd like to thank them one more time. So they are Ear Trumpet Labs microphones, which I'm talking into right now, funnily enough. Spectra 1964 that makes killer recording equipment, Black Mountain Thumb Picks, which I use all the time, Union Tube and Transistor Pedals, which has been with me since day one, and Isotope, who make all kinds of groovy, amazing plugins, which I also use. I try to keep the sponsors relevant to music and to stuff that I actually use, and so far that's worked out well. All those companies make amazing stuff, and you should check them out and support them. That leaves the listeners, and you guys have been great this year with both one-time donations and Patreon subscriptions. Those are super helpful, even between seasons, as all my hard costs continue, even when the shows aren't coming out regularly. So keep them going if you're a fan of the show, and it'll help kick things in for season 7. While you're at it, if you don't mind, please leave a rating or a review and or a review over at Apple Podcasts. That really helps the cause too. I still don't think you can do that on Spotify, but if you can, then please do it there. I know they're going to start, but I don't know if they've actually started doing that yet or not. I had some new backers this week, and I'd like to thank them now. These are actually from the last few weeks. I got a bit behind on thanking people on the show. Anyway, here they are. James Patsula. Hope I got that right. Rowan Palmer, Alan G. Moses, Chris Weber, Jim McKendrick. Thank you all so much. Now, as I mentioned before on previous episodes, Union Tube and Transistor, one of our sponsors, has donated a really cool reverb pedal to be given away, and I promised to do that on the last show of the season, and that's right now. So here it is. The groovy prize is a Union C-Verb pedal. It's a really cool reverb pedal that has a sort of a trippy ambient reverb side. There's like a normal reverb side and then a trippy ambient reverb side. It's really good. So all you had to do to be eligible was to sign up on Patreon. So if you did that, you are entered. And with that, the winner of the Union C-Verb pedal is George Wells. So George Wells, hit me up through the website or Patreon, or I'll just reach out to you. And I've got this pedal here and I'll send it out to you. ASAP. One other bit of news from here is that the henhouse hang that I've been talking about, we've decided to change things slightly. It's still going to be a multi-day recording workshop here in Nashville at my place, the henhouse, but we're getting a number of inquiries from people who wanted to get their own place or had a friend they could stay with or were from Nashville. And that just wasn't an option. So what we've done is we've taken the accommodations out of the equation and made the whole thing way cheaper. And it leaves you to find your own accommodations, but there's tons of great deals around, and so now it's much more affordable. So if you want to come to Nashville, hang out, and take part in this multi-day session and learn a bunch of cool stuff about recording and mixing with me and some friends, it's September 25 through 27, and there's still a couple spots left. All the info for that is at stevedawson.ca. I'm also going out on tour in April and May with my band, just doing a few shows in Western Canada this time. I've got a brand new album out called Eyes Closed Dreaming that you can order now if you're interested. And we're going to be playing music from the 3 records I put out over the last year. So if you're in Western or Central Canada, please come see us. The dates are all on my website now and tickets are available to there at stevedawson.ca. Okay, I think that's about it. Let's get down to the final episode. Jerry Douglas. He's a total legend and probably needs very little introduction here. But I will say that there's a select few musicians on the planet who have undeniably redefined their instrument, so much so that you can't really play that instrument without being influenced by them, or you draw comparisons to that person, whether you like it or not. Jaco Pastorius comes to mind on the fretless bass, or Jimi Hendrix, or Jeff Beck on the electric guitar. Maybe Mississippi John Hurt or Chet Atkins come to mind as well. And then, of course, on the dobro, Jerry Douglas. He's had an incredibly prolific career, starting in the mid-70s with The Country Gentleman and J.D. Crowe, through the groundbreaking group Boone Creek with Ricky Skaggs, and some incredible work with Buck White. That's sort of the early period of Jerry's career before he becomes a session kingpin. And I'm not even going to begin to list his credit highlights because we'd be here all day. But you can look them up if you want. But you may know already. The number of records he's played on is somewhere seemingly around 1,600, which is insane. He's been nominated for 32 Grammys, won 14 of them, and is a 10-time IBMA winner of Dobro Player of the Year. His production credits are amazing too, and that really came to the fore with his work with Alison Krauss in Union Station. Not to mention his recent work with John Hiatt. They made a really cool record together last year. And Molly Tuttle, whose record that just won a Grammy he produced, or co-produced with Molly, I think. Jerry's really active with his own incredible band and continues to produce and tour seemingly nonstop. He's been involved in a ton of dobro innovations as well, which are really interesting and cool. We're going to get into all that stuff and more. So, without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Jerry Douglas. You just got back from somewhere.
Yeah, I've been in the UK for a couple of 3 months.
3 months?
I just got back.
Man. Oh my God, how was that?
It's good, but mostly good. Mostly good.
Thanks for doing this, man. I appreciate it. I've been hoping to get you on this show for a while, and I've had lots of people that are in your world, but never had a chance to have you on here before. One of the issues that I have when I bring someone like you on is like it's hard to know where to start. I mean, your career's been massive. It's been going for a long time, and also like somebody like you that's kind of redefined the instrument. It's bananas to think of like where it was when you first started and where it's come now. And so yeah. I guess a good place to start is like when you were a youngster and starting out, obviously, you know, you had some traditional bluegrass dobro influences that maybe we could talk about, but were you also aware of the limitations of the instrument and aware of as yourself trying to push the boundaries of what it could do? Or did you just want to play some bluegrass with your pals? Like what was your mindset when you were a kid?
Yeah, I had no ideas about limitations or otherwise, you know, about the instrument. I was just trying to learn how to play it within the confines of bluegrass music at that point when I started playing. And there was no one around where I lived that, you know, knew what bluegrass music was, let alone a dobro or, you know, how to tune it or anything like that. So everything was like, from grassroots. My dad had a bluegrass band, so he had a banjo player, and we figured, well, the first four strings I'll have to be tuned like this. And then I guess we'll just go an octave down from there, like a steel or something. So I think...
So you just literally took a guess at how it was supposed to be
really
set up?
I really did, man. Just like, there was nothing like we have now, you know? There was no internet. There was nothing like that. And there were records. There were records and there were live shows that you could go to. And if you could get close enough, you could see how somebody was playing it and try to figure it out. But the guys in my dad's band were really great to let, you know, a 10, 11, 12-year-old kid in. And they were good. They were really good. Yeah. They were just all mill workers. So they had already, you know, sort of cut out their lot in life and had kids and couldn't run off from the families and go get roads. So they stayed where they were, but they were good musicians. Oh, you got the dogs just like I do.
And, yeah, that's Ringo.
but I didn't have a teacher. I didn't have anybody. You mean I had these guys that would kind of like go, that sounds right.
So it's interesting then, like, you grew up in Ohio. I don't know what part exactly, but it's interesting to me that you ended up with the dobro. Like, what drew you to it if there was nobody, like, saying, hey, man, check this out, this is cool, like, take this and tune it this way? If you had none of that, what drew you to it in the first place?
Well, it was all Josh Graves' fault, okay. and Earl Scruggs, you know, those two were my musicians, go-to musicians. And, you know, Earl Scruggs first, I remember first being a huge banjo fan, you know, or whatever a little kid is to, you know, I like that.
Yeah.
You know, I like that one. But then Josh Graves, I just remember when he played Randy Lynn Rag, you know, there were so many sounds that came out of that guitar during his solo. It still baffles me how he did
really?
how you do all of that. I mean, I can do it now, but it's just amazing. It's a great instrument. I mean, there are a lot of things you can do with it, and he did kind of all of them in one solo. You know,
that's interesting that you point out that one particular one. So that was the one for you that you were just like, "Holy crap, this is
insane." It was just like slash and burn his way through there. You know, there was take no prisoner, this guy. And he just bulldozed his way through this solo. And it was incredible, you know, what he did. I mean, even now, for somebody to come up with a solo that was that well constructed, that had all the elements of how you play this funny looking guitar.
Right.
All of them in it, you know, is amazing to me.
So were you able to pick it out on your, like, were you able to figure any of that out on your dobro, or did you ever get a chance to see him play or anything?
I did see him play. I saw him play. I saw Flatten Strokes play twice, 63 and 66, something like that. I mean,
so they were like really in their prime.
Oh yeah. They were cranking they seemed so self-assured. You know, there was no work involved in what they were doing. They were like actors on a stage. Wow. They were going through the same motions they were going to go through the next night, and just trying to shine it up. I've come to realize that after playing so many years and so many gigs, and that you know, you might play the same song the next night, but you're going to try to do something to it to make it better than it was the night before, you know.
Yeah.
Even if it's subconsciously, you're trying to improve. You're trying to make something a little better. One little edge of a slide or a string, you know, a note here or there. That for me, I remember the things that happened the night before that I did that I want to change or that I want to smooth out or finesse. And I think that's what they were doing. I mean, and some nights they would just take a chance and go off the reservation, you know, total. Mm-hmm. And we did that. We did that in Union Station as well, because we were playing.
Absolutely.
We were playing big shows, and we were playing mostly the same show every night. So every night was, you know, you played. It sounded like better than a record. Eventually, because we had all the chances to flush out the little tiny parts, you know, the little hidden parts. And so we just shined those things every night, and they got a little bit better. But I remember on Tuesday nights, I kind of plotted out Tuesday nights as my night that I would just not do that. Not
really.
Not, I'd play the intro to the song so we knew what song it was and everything. So the audience kind of knew what was going on. Clue them.
And you just went for it.
And then go. Yeah.
On a Tuesday night.
All bets are off. That was my night.
So,
my night to go.
So if you saw Union Station on a Tuesday night, you were in for some Jerry Douglas mayhem.
Yeah, at least me.
That's,
and I think
that's hilarious.
Dan was in on it too. Dan and Ron were in on it too. Barry
knew
what he had to do, but the rest of us were like, I'm not taking the same solo I usually take, you know, just
because. What about Allison? Was she in on that?
No. No, she had too much on her plate. She had to be the angel voice, you know, that around it. So somebody had to stay upright.
Oh man, that's funny. I love that you did that on Tuesdays.
That in my mind, Tuesdays are the nights, you know, it's like a Tuesday night's not, you know, a prime concert night. If you fell on your face, you know, fewer people saw that, but we didn't fall on our face much.
And so what does a guy like you do to like really push yourself? Like, where does that take you? Like, are you talking like harmonically or like right hand, or what kind of stuff were you messing with that you wouldn't normally go near on a Wednesday night?
Well, Wednesday night was easier than Tuesday night. I would probably start the solo in a different position, you know, maybe same note, but in a different position on a different string that would lead me to some other direction. But I love melody, you know, so I'll always come back to the melody at some point and re-interject that back in there so we all know where we are. Otherwise it was like, don't listen to me, okay? Don't listen to what I'm playing, just play your part. Go listen to me, because I'm gonna do something. I'm not sure what I'm gonna do.
That's so cool. And then did you find that for the rest of the week that you would be influenced by like weird things that you might have done on the Tuesday free-for-all?
Yeah, Wednesday and Thursday were still things going through my head that hadn't cleared out on Tuesday. Yeah.
That's so cool, man. I've never heard of anyone doing that. That's really cool.
You have to when you do that many shows. You have to let yourself go at some point, you know. You can't just do it all to entertain the audience. You have to entertain yourself or they're not going to be entertained, you know.
Right.
And we were up there having a blast, you know, playing this music that we loved. And that translates to the audience, you know. But then, then here comes Tuesday night, and it's like, all of a sudden you're on a sled instead.
Yeah. Did Allison ever clue into that? Did she ever go, "Hey guys, that was pretty out there tonight"?
Well, we never talked about it.
Okay.
We never talked about it. It was just sort of an unspoken thing.
I love it.
We did, and one somebody would start it, and then it's like it's on, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that really was like just such a high caliber band. Like every single person in that band, it was like the greatest player of their instrument. It was really quite something. I never got a chance to see Union Station, but judging from the records, like it was quite the thing.
Ron would, you know, for instance, Ron would kick off the Lucky One or something like that. He would kick it off like he always did, but his solo might start with the same note, but then it was going to go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was fun. Everybody was on into it. I know Allison knew what was going on. She's got she's got bat ears, so she knew what we were doing, but you know, it's still within spec, you know.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
So one of the interesting things I think about your playing is like the really lyrical quality, where you're playing like really legato stuff that is a big contrast to the faster open string kind of stuff that's more like banjo oriented that you do. And I'm just wondering, like, where did that stuff come from? Because I don't hear a ton of that with the early generation of dobro players. Like I hear more of the banjo oriented kind of stuff and a lot of, you know, roles and things like that. But a lot of the lead stuff, like, were you influenced by people other than the standard dobro guys?
Well, I got, you know, I had Tony Rice to bounce off of a lot, you know, who introduced me more to the jazz genre, you know. And I mean, because when I
was he playing stuff for you that you hadn't been exposed to?
He was just, I'd go out to board with Tony, and we would stay up all night and listen to Miles Davis and Eric Dolphy and all these major heavy jazz cats, you know. And then you would kind of go away from that with this whole different slant on what's possible, you know. Mm-hmm. And with Tony and, you know, listening to Django Reinhardt, listening to Earl, George Benson, you know, there are just all these guitar players, Clapton. And because I had no dobro players to go to get ideas from, really, I got my ideas from saxophone players and from electric guitar players and, you know, other genres of music, which maybe didn't translate directly into what they were doing, but I made fit into what we were doing.
Yeah, right.
You know, phrasing techniques and things like that, you know, just to kind of like give the, you know, instead of bam, 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 you know, it's like bam, 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 you know,
yeah.
Like, you know, give it a breath somewhere and let it give it, you know, and sort of, it was sort of like, yes, take a look this way, take a look this way, which is the best direction to go, you know, it's like,
yeah.
It's visual in it as well. So, music is a wonderful thing. It's such a release in it, and you can really see inside of someone, and know more about their personality if you hear them play an instrument more than you can if you talk to them. You know, mm-hmm. conversation. You know, you kind of get where they're coming from, what attitude they're playing with, you know, so you know where, if they're coming from, you know, like I said, like a Josh Graves was just like slash and burn, but sometimes I've heard him play like the most beautiful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it just had to do with the song substance and listening to what was going on around him. I do the same thing. I need something to bounce off of. But yeah, I say that right after I just did, you know, 40 solo gigs. So no one to bounce off of. So you're just sort of like, okay, which you're kind of free to go to improvise anytime. And right. You just want to drag the crowd along with you. You don't want to leave them behind.
Of course.
I hate to do that. I hate thinking that I just left somebody behind and they don't know where I am or they don't know what I'm doing. You know, they don't know what song it is anymore. You know, so sometimes I'll leave a breadcrumb here and there.
Yeah, with Tony, I feel like he probably sat down and like I can hear, you know, like Coltrane licks here and there or Miles licks or things like that. You can tell that he probably sat down and like figured some of that shit out. Did you ever get to the point where you were working out? I don't hear it necessarily literally like that in your playing.
No, he worked more from scales than I do.
Okay.
For Tony, that's, but he would figure out, you know, Miles played this here to release his solo into somebody else's solo. Things like that, Tony would pick up on how to get out of a solo, how to get into a solo, you know, some landmark in the middle. And we all do that. But with him, it was like, okay, I'm going to plant this here that I learned from Eric Dolphy. I'm going to plant this over here, this Django thing or this Miles thing, you know. But yeah. Just a scale, just like reverse the scale, or you know, turn it inside out. He knew a lot about that, and he was set up to play fast because he kept it all in one area. You know, he had up and down from the top to the bottom of the strings, but he had figured out the scales within a small space.
Yeah, interesting.
But for
efficiency,
efficiency and motion, yeah, and I try to do the same thing. I try to keep it all kind of close together. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you need to just go get an open note. You know, if there is one, get that open note and then work from that. You know, then go into some. Yeah, we all have our maximum audience response kind of things that we'll throw out there when we feel we're losing them a little bit. You know?
Right. Well, this will work.
Yeah. They're not following. Okay. Boom. Okay. Now we're back on track. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's like following a treasure map.
So what was the, like, historically, what happened? Like, J.D. Crowe had you and Tony Rice in his band at the same time. You guys were probably like 19 or something, right? I don't, was Tony the same age as you roughly, or is he older than you?
He was 3 years older than me.
Okay. So, like, how did that happen? Where did he come from? How did you meet JD? How was he so smart to get you little whippersnappers in his band? Like, what was going on with that whole thing?
Well, he had Tony, first of all, you know, and Tony was just a blank canvas, more or less, for Crow.
Where was Tony from?
Tony originally is from Danville, Virginia, but most of his most he grew up mostly in California,
Okay.
around LA.
And were you aware of him before the J.D. Crowe thing, or was he just a kid playing with J.D. Crowe?
No, I was aware of him, but not before he was with J.D. Crowe. I know that, you know, now talking with Sam and everybody of their history in Bluegrass Alliance, you know, in Louisville, that's where Tony first shows up. That's
Okay.
the adult Tony first shows up is there, and sort of Sam sort of guiding him through, you know, you need
Okay.
insurance, you know, stuff like that. And giving him sort of the fundamentals of adult life. And then Tony, he just, you know, he just was that guy who was going to be more interested. And he loved Doc's playing. You know, I know he loved all these different guitar players and Clarence. You know, Clarence was his
Yeah.
guy, but so was Dan Crary and all these other people that he would. And he was a sponge, and he just absorbed all this stuff. But he had this other stuff. And when he met David Grisman, he went up a notch. He went up a step, few steps. I mean, and got to actually apply these things he'd been listening to. So that makes a big difference. You can listen to it all day long, but then to go ahead and apply it to something that some kind of music that you play. That's the difference. That's when you've grown. That's when you've taken a step out the door there.
And so what was that scene like? Like, when you guys were both with J.D. Crowe, were you playing like festivals and touring all over the place, or was it pretty regional? Or like, what was the original lineup situation? And also, was he like a really, he must have been a pretty nurturing band leader and letting you guys rip and stuff, right? Like, was that a big part of
Crow was totally that guy, and he was a funny guy, and just a real honest, you know, sit down, he'll tell you exactly what he thinks, and you know, there's no pulling punches, anything like that. He just was a straight up guy. I never had a cross word with JD Crowe ever in my life, ever knowing JD. Loved that guy. And I came into that band, I mean, that was a step up for me. That was a step up in my musical education from the Country Gentlemen, my playing music that they were doing, and at one point near they were that band, and then this is just how the evolution of all of this is going, and then there then came along Mike Aldridge playing with the Seldom Scene and playing these songs, different kinds of songs that didn't have to be breakneck speeds, but he came up with you know, sort of a modern pop dobro kind of thing, kind of he reinvented it the way before I did, and I just took the fiddle tunes and the faster tunes, and then figured out all the other stuff, you know, clued into what Mike was doing, and I had nobody to listen to besides Mike and Josh Graves. That was kind of it, that were really going to teach me something. And but playing with JD and I first what you know it was a very it's all happened in a pretty short amount of time that I played on the record and then the record that was in 75 and oh God, this is so long ago, but
it's so long ago.
yeah, But I was, yeah, I was 18. Then I turned 19 while I was in Crow's band. And we were just all so young and ready for, you know, whatever.
What did you learn about recording? Because those recordings are so good and they really stand up as like, you know, they don't sound dated or shitty or anything. Like, they just sound like a great band playing really well. Was it pretty simply done, those records? Or like, did you learn stuff about making records in those early recordings?
I had no idea what they were going to record, but okay. I was getting used to being in the studio.
Yeah.
It's a different world, and I love it there. Cause you get
clearly,
or you get another chance.
Right.
and I've become a good, pretty good editor too, but it was, you know, it was all analog tape machine, two inch 16 track at mm-hmm. Track Studios there in Silver Springs, where we recorded that record. And
what state? Silver Springs,
Maryland.
Maryland. Okay.
And right outside, right in the, inside the Beltway in DC.
Yeah.
That's where the scene had been. Seldom Scene had been recording there,
and okay.
kind of where it was a bluegrass friendly recording studio.
Yeah,
that had the right kind of microphones and an engineer that kind of knew where to place the microphones. Because I hadn't been in a studio that much, I didn't know exactly where the microphone should go, but I had a pretty good idea that it didn't go all the way up front where all the bass was, and it didn't go all the way to the back where all the treble was. You know, you want to find, if you only had one microphone to use, you want to find the best spot on your instrument where the sound was coming out, you know, the best mix of the sound of your instrument. Because, you know, we all you know, guitars and mandolins and violins, I guess, have one, just sort of one great big spot where you can, you
yep.
cover them, but when it gets to banjos and dobros, things like that that have different, have metal and wood, you've got to search around a little bit to find the sweet spot. And
yeah.
and then I got into stereo miking, finding, you know, just completely encapsulating the whole sound, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Getting on the perimeters of each of those two sounds that I wanted to get and putting them together.
Yeah.
And that way you could pan, you know, you could do things.
Right. Make like it real wide.
Whatever you wanted, wherever you wanted to put it, you know, or you wanted it to be concentrated. But that's stuff that I learned, you know, starting in there. I think the first record I ever made was in New York City at Vanguard Studios with the Country Gentlemen, and I stayed in the Chelsea Hotel.
Cool. There's an experience for you.
I was 16.
Oh, shit.
First time I'd ever flown, first time I'd been to New York City, first time I'd recorded. It was all like mind-blowing, you know, and at the same time, I'm staying there, you know. A couple of years later, Sid Vicious is there, you know, and I think Andy Warhol was there at the time, and a guy I met later, Sandy Bull, who was at one time a huge guy, part of the great folk scare of the '60s. He was involved in that, but he was a junkie, and he was living upstairs in the Chelsea.
That's where you go when you're messed up and you're in New York and you need some shit.
That's why they put us in that hotel, I suppose. And but I didn't leave that street. I ate at the same restaurant every day. I mean, I wasn't there but like 3 or 4 days. It seems like we were there for 2 weeks, but it, because of so much input. You know, New York City, the first time you go there is you can either be scary or exciting. Whichever way you want to go with it.
Yeah. And
I decided to go to the scary line that time. But since then, I'm all over it. I love New York City. I love a place like that.
Me too.
But so it was a big step for me to go from that to Crow. But one of the reasons I did it was because Ricky Skaggs and I were both in the Country Gentlemen together. And Larry Rice quit JD's band, and Ricky took that position. And he said, JD, you know, some of these songs would sound good with dobro on them. And JD was like, I don't know if we want to somebody from outside the band, you know, or another instrument or anything like that. But I got in there. I was only going to play on like two songs, but I ended up playing on like eight or nine. So I think I won him over.
And I think you passed the audition.
I think I passed the audition. And it wasn't long after that at all that I moved to Lexington and joined the band.
Oh, okay. And so that's where you sort of started Boone Creek with yeah. Ricky Skaggs.
We were only in, I was only in the J.D. Crow band from
a couple of years, right?
June 1st to sometime in September when we came back from Japan, and it was all over. Tony was going to work with David Grisman, and Ricky and I always wanted to start a band. Keith Whitley was going to be in that band, and Mark and some other guys, but Ricky and I were the only ones that ended up being in the band and getting other guys to take the places of the ringers that we had all set up, you know?
Right.
So, yeah.
So what was the idea with Boone Creek? Like, were you guys deliberately trying to be like a younger generation of players that were, you know, making a statement?
We didn't write. So we had all of these older songs, but we give them this different bend, you know? We took what we knew from, you know, all these other musics that we've been listening to and interjected those things in it. Plus we had an electric bass for the first time. So that kind of loosened things up a little bit.
That probably pissed some people off, eh?
Pissed a lot of people off. And but that didn't seem to last very long. You know, after they caught on to what we were actually doing, Then they were kind of okay with all the rest of it, you know. But we built quite a fan base, you know, in the short period of time that we were together for like 2.5-3 years, and I went from there to
what happened. Like, what happened to that band?
We really started to get to where we were really, the festivals were coming in, things were really starting to pop, and Ricky got an offer from Emmy Lou Harris.
Okay.
And that was the end of the band. And okay. And I went with Buck White, Sharon and Cheryl, and with that band, Wes took off. Wes went back to North Carolina. Terry Balcom went pretty much straight to Doyle Lawson, had gotten out of the Country Gentleman at that point and started his band. And Terry Balcom was his first banjo player. And
awesome.
And the other guys just kind of like went, you know, with the wind. But I kept working. I moved first to the Country Gentleman for a couple of months, and then I sort of gave myself a deadline. I said, if something doesn't start happening, you know, pretty soon, I can always go to college, you know?
Now, okay. But then you ended up with Emmy Lou. Like, I don't know if you were in her band or not, but you're on those records, right? Like, that was right then, wasn't it?
I ended up being on the records. Yeah. And that was Ricky too, going, you know, this would be nice, you know, to Brian Ahern. If Mike Aldridge had played on a couple of things for her originally, and they liked the sound of it. And then when they got Ricky in there, he kind of said, well, you know, my friend Jerry Douglas can do this. And so here I come and go do that. And the Whites, the girls were singing on the records too. So better band to go out and open for her than us, you know? So we go out and do our thing. And then it was just Buck, the two girls, and me, and then opening for Emmy Lou Harris, and it was great. And they loved us, and we sort of became part of her band, and it was just a big caravan at that point.
Yeah, so that record, so Roses in the Snow was probably like, I don't know, 77, 78 or something like that, and that's like I find that to be a really interesting record because it's so traditional instrumentation wise, and like the approach is pretty trad, but the songs are like a whole different ball of wax, and
yeah,
the way that you guys play is also different. Like it's a different approach to playing bluegrass, and it sort of comes across as bluegrass, but not really.
Yeah, I can't remember. There wasn't really a heavy drum kit on that song. It wasn't a drum. They weren't drum records. They weren't full band records, country band records for Emmy.
Yeah, I don't think there's any drums on Roses in the Snow. I think it's a bluegrass instrumentation.
She was talking about this the other day. We were talking. She and Ricky and I were talking. We had occasion to sit down and do a little podcast thing, and we were talking, and Emmy Lou said she took so much flack from the record company from Warner Brothers saying there's no way anybody's going to like this.
Oh my God.
They want you to do Elite Hotel. They want you to do Luxury Liner. That's what they want. Yep. And I'm thinking, yeah, so do I, you know, so why can't this be part of it too? You know, and it ended up being it. And so she had a multifaceted show. But yeah, she had a lot of trouble convincing the record company that this would work at all. And
weird.
there was Blue Kentucky Girl then. Blue Kentucky Girl was more in the hot band line. And then this one we're talking about. And then after that, she cut a Light of the Stable, the Christmas record around the same time. It's sort of the same band.
You did those records in LA, right?
Yeah. They had Emmy Lou and Brian,
It was like in their house or something, right?
They had a house on the street called Lania Lane. It was off of Coldwater Canyon when you would cut across the mountain from Ventura Boulevard that went into Hollywood, cut across the mountain and Coldwater Canyon was the road you went across the mountain on. You could end up on Mulholland Drive. You could go up there, or you could go on down and go in closer to LA. But there's your geography lesson for the day. But Ricky and I got in a little fender bender with John Voight one time on that road, and he was really rude. But
really,
nothing really happened. But they had this house, and they had the Enactron truck, Brian's truck, backed up to the house, which was the studio, and everything. All the lines ran in the house. But the big mudslide took the house out. And Brian moved the truck in advance, so he kept the truck safe.
And you mean like while you were making the record, the house got totaled?
All the gear, yeah, it was.
Oh my God.
Right in that period that the mountain came down on, and every night we'd be recording coyotes, you know, outside surrounding the house because they heard the music. They'd come down and howl at the house. Yeah. It was an interesting period. Yeah.
But yeah. Do you remember like what you would have learned from that situation where you've got like clearly your role is to highlight the singer who's like a big star at the time, but Brian's the producing also. And I guess they're husband and wife at the time, but also he's a pretty like, opinionated guy, as far as what I know. Like, what was that whole dynamic like?
Oh, we followed Brian. Whatever Brian said, yeah. Did, you know. And Brian gave me the best and most used, probably, advice I've ever had for being in the studio, and especially in backing up a vocal. We were early on into whatever we were doing, whatever record we were doing, and I played something and he stopped and he said, the best thing you can do is stay out of her range. When she's singing, don't get in her range, because then you start to fight each other and you can actually cancel each other out.
Yep.
Just by playing in the same register. So some divide it up, you know, be somewhere else, anywhere, mm-hmm. and it'll work. And that that is the honest to God truth, man. That should be in the Bible. I mean, don't play on the top of the female singer.
At that time, were you like, oh my God, yeah, I am totally doing that. I need to change. Or were you already like thinking that way?
I already kind of thought that way, but it was just one situation where I got in there and he just reaffirmed it for me that you don't do that. I mean, that you're painting. You know, I mean, it's like you're an artist and you're surrounding this thing and you don't want to detract from it. You want to enhance it is what you really want to do. You might want to play a harmony against it, even on a couple of notes, which ghosts sounds like another person when a dobro does it. But, and Ricky had a really good fiddle thing going on where you had a viola between two violins and it was like a fiddle sandwich kind of thing. That was if you go back and listen to those records, when you hear the fiddle solos, you hear all these three and it's like,
oh wow.
Well, three is better than one. Gets the point across.
So for me, like as a fan of your playing and sort of being aware of, you know, I'm sure I don't know everything you've ever done, but like I'm aware of certain periods of your career. And that to me is sort of like late, early period of your playing and your session work. Do you remember what you were playing like guitar wise and how you were miking it back in those days? Because that for me is like a real high point of how the dobro sounds on those Emmylou records. It's spectacular.
That was a guitar. I think the first things I played on her records was that was an old dobro. First things I played, and then I moved to a guitar called an RQ Jones, Rudy Jones, a guy out in Oklahoma in the middle of nowhere was building the next version of a dobro guitar, you know.
When would that have been that you hooked up with him?
79, 80.
Okay.
And I think I got that guitar in 80 and used that guitar all the way up to, you know, 87, 88 when I started using Tim Shearhorn guitars.
So what did the RQ Jones give you that you weren't getting from an old dobro?
It was multi-voiced. It had more voices. It had more of a singing high end, and it was constructed differently, where it didn't have like Dobro's have a in the body of the guitar have a sound well that's built into the guitar, and Rudy Jones took that out and put support posts like are in violins and basses.
Yeah.
To transmit the sound from the top to the bottom and let this air move. And, you know, it's just, he said, think of it like water, air, you know, the music, all the air is moving in the guitar like water would or light would be reflected. It's moving.
Now. Oh, interesting.
And so he built a guitar that had posts inside, sound posts inside of it, instead of this round barrel that had holes in it that would let the sound out, but didn't truly disperse the sound that's coming off the underside of that cone. It's
right.
Pretty good, pretty difficult instrument to describe how it works, but all of the bass is up in the top chamber of the guitar, you know, where the screens are.
And then
I started popping the screen out on the treble side because I knew that's where all the bass from the guitar came. So I would get the microphone, I'd pop that screen, I'd get more bass from the guitar, and I could then find my sweet spot of the cover plate and the screen. And because that screen was open, there was more bass, so I could move back into the treble a little bit more, you know, and edge, you know.
Yep.
Or it depended on the track. If the track was really thick, I wanted a thinner sound. If the track was wide open, woody instruments, you know, on the track, I would.
Did you keep the screens on hand and like pop them in and out depending on what you were looking for?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I mean, it was just another way of, you know, instead of moving my chair,
yeah,
pop a screen and there's more low end. And if I needed more low end for my solo or for my backup or something, I would leave that, you know.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, this huge, beautiful bass note would come out of the guitar instead of it being sort of damped down. But I keep the screens in the guitar when I'm playing it live. Most people have just pulled the screens completely. But I think there's a use for those.
They sort of disperse the bass a little bit and make it a little
There's some compression. There's some compression there, and it kind of holds it into a uniform sound. And when you start popping screens,
right,
you're messing with the design, you know,
yeah,
a little bit.
Yeah.
But you know, you know if you know what you're doing, you can make it work.
Right.
And that's when I started popping screens, then I started noticing everybody's popping their screens now. So they're like, do I play a trick on them and put them back in, or what do I do? But that's just the way it went. And now
put toilet paper over them, and suddenly everyone's got toilet paper over
them.
Yeah,
so like put toilet paper over an NS10, a monitor. We used to do that. Yamaha came out with these great speakers.
Yeah, man.
For near field speakers, but the tweeter was too bright, so we put a couple sheets of Kleenex or toilet paper and pasted it over that tweeter, and it brought it back within normal specs, you know, where you could listen to it longer. Yeah.
This show is brought to you by the good folks at iZotope, who make incredible plug-in software for any music or dialogue recording situation. Among other things, they make a very unique suite of software called RX, which you can use to surgically repair almost any kind of issue in a recording. Whether it's removing electrical hum, unwanted noise, vocal plosives, or almost anything you can throw at it. I use iZotope RX on every mix in one way or another, and I love that I can get in there on guitar tracks that I'm doing and running through my crazy old tube amps and get rid of the hum and noise without affecting the actual tone of the guitar. You can buy their plugins outright or get a subscription to keep up to date on all their latest versions. Right now, they're offering listeners a 10% discount on any of their plugins when you use the code SOULPOD10 at checkout. So head on over to iZotope.com/soulpod, and you'll see the links right there to get the discount or an extended 30-day trial of their subscription service of Music Production Suite Pro. We're also brought to you this season by Black Mountain Picks. These are unique spring-loaded thumb picks that are super comfortable and adaptable. I've been using them for a couple years now, and I absolutely love them. They come in medium gauge, heavy gauge, jazz-tipped, left-handed, and with regular or extra tight spring tension. Check them out at blackmountainpicks.com. Also thanks to Ear Trumpet Labs, a workshop in Portland, Oregon, hand-building amazing sounding microphones. These large diaphragm condensers combine state-of-the-art sound with eye-catching designs and the feedback control to excel live as well as in the studio. I am using their Edwina myself right now on this podcast. Check them out at eartrumpetlabs.com. And finally, the Henhouse Hang. It's a 4-day immersive recording experience right here with me at the Henhouse Studio in East Nashville on September 19 to 22nd, 2022. Join us for a musical learning experience like no other. We'll put you up in a groovy hotel, feed you some glorious food, show you the ropes of recording roots and Americana music by bringing you in on a real session with real musicians working on real songs from the ground up. You can get all the info on that at stevedawson.ca. Just follow the links on the front page to the Henhouse Hang. All right, then, let's get back to the show. Did you do any other like unusual stuff as far as miking? Like I did a session with Bill Vorndick a while ago, and he's like, with Jerry, man, we always put a piece of tape over the, like he had some weird thing with tape over the ends, like the ball ends of the strings. And he was doing it to my dobro. And I was like, wow, that's weird, but okay. But he said that there was some tape thing. Like, did you ever do any like really unusual?
Oh yeah, we didn't tape. I don't remember taping anything. We would, you know, that space between the cover, between the bridge and the tailpiece. There are a lot of harmonics in there, so we would put a lot of foam underneath that to kill those harmonics, and then everything happened in the front. You know, that helped.
Right.
You didn't get any ghost tones, any ghost sounds, you know, any whining or rattling things, you know. Dobros are dobros.
Oh yeah.
They can take they can create a new sound for themselves all the time. You have to hunt it down, finding rid of it.
So in the 80s, at some point, you switched over to a Shearhorn.
A Shearhorn, yeah. Tim Shearhorn came to the show I was doing, American Music Shop. It was a TV show we were doing down here. And he brought, his first dobro, and I went, man, this is definitely a step up. And then this is a step ahead from where we are right now. So I said, yeah, I'd love for you to build me one of these guitars. So he built me one, and I said, it was the same size as a regular size dobro size body of just like a dobro copy. And I said, what if you built like a bigger one? You can build a guitar this small that sounds as good. You build a bigger guitar, not a full-size dreadnought guitar, not that big, but take what you're doing to the inside of the guitar, and just make the whole guitar bigger, but keep your
and deeper too, or the same depth.
Deeper,
yeah,
thicker, and just a bigger body, just more sound,
Yeah,
and it worked. It really worked. I mean, and then that's all anybody wanted was a Shearhorn guitar.
Right.
And I did a deal with Gibson when they bought Dobro. They were really wanting to bring Dobro back. And I was too. I thought, man, that'd be great if you could go into a music store and buy a Dobro.
A decent Dobro that's actually a Dobro, yeah.
For a decent price,
Yeah.
Not go like go crazy, but we designed, I did the design and we built this guitar. And when you put your name on a guitar, everybody thinks you built it yourself. Any complaints, they come to you. They don't go to the guitar company.
Right.
You start hearing about how your guitars suck. And the Gibsons were terrible. And they kept, every time I'd go in and visit.
The Gibson, like the Jerry Douglas Gibsons were terrible?
A few of them were good. I'd teach a guy how to set it up, and then they'd take him to the electric department, and then put some new guy in there who'd never seen a Dobro before. And it just kept happening. And I was getting complaints. Your guitars, man, really? That's you? You did that? And so I got a divorce from Gibson. But I was looking for somebody to do a signature guitar, and Tim wasn't really, he was at that point kind of trying to slow down, and I'm wanting to speed up, and it's just man operation, and it wasn't going to happen. So I went to Paul Beard, who was building bigger body guitars. He was building the one for Mike Aldridge that was amazing. It sounded like a piano. This thing was huge sounding. And so I went to Paul and we talked about, designs and stuff on the inside and stuff like that. And we produced a signature model guitar. And we've got two.
And that's what you're currently playing.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm playing a Blackbeard right now. The original guitar that he and I designed together was made out of this Sapelli, this mahogany that was very, very, had a lot of figure in it. Had a quilted effect. You could see down into the grain of this guitar. It's a beautiful guitar, beautiful wood. And so we only had enough wood to make 50 of those.
Okay.
So we started making, and I said, the first Dobro I ever saw, it was must have been like a Dobro trainer or something, because it had no binding on it. It was black. And it had a red fingerboard. And he said, a red fingerboard? Nobody wants that. I said, yeah, I do. So that
is like not red wood, but like red, like painted red, you mean?
No, well, the Dobro may have been painted red, but this, we just took some mahogany or some kind of wood and stained it to where it's very, very reddish looking.
Cool.
Different from the guitar is totally black, but it's translucent finish, so you can still see the grain, but it's black. And we called that a Blackbeard. And that's the biggest selling guitar he has still.
Okay.
After all the time. So, and I love it. And then we started doing, then I put this hip shot thing on it where I could change the tunings instead of taking two guitars with me, I could just take one guitar. And
so are there individual switches where you're flicking them in to change the tuning of the entire guitar, or is it just one thing?
There was one. There's just one. There was a trilogy. Okay.
I had a trilogy.
And you could get three tunings out of the trilogy.
Yeah.
Really. But it's slow. If you want to change to a different, you know, that third tuning, you're going to be there for a couple seconds, you know.
Yeah.
Just remembered which ones to pull of those six.
Right.
But this is one lever, and it changes everything from a G, normal G do ro tuning, to a drop D.
Wow.
Open drop D. So that bottom string drops from G all the way down to D, and it comes up in tune every time.
And it sort of, does it compensate the other strings too?
Yeah, well, there are individual tuning, little tuning on each string back on that on the hip shot. So
amazing.
If you open it up and that D string is too sharp, you can give it a little bit more slack back here, or you can tighten it down. You can tune it down. You know, you can tune the string up or down. Yeah,
yeah.
It's not a hard thing. I mean, it's just Dave Borzov, this guy, just designed. He said it was the first thing he designed, and he threw it in the corner. Didn't think anybody would ever use it. I said, "Go get it."
The other really cool innovation you have is the Aura system. That are you still using that? The Jerry Douglas Aura. Yeah,
yeah.
I have a funny story about that. I was playing at the Vancouver Island Music Festival up in Comox, and you were there. And you were—I can't remember even who you were playing with, but you did a dobro workshop. My friend Ivan Rosenberg was on it, and a couple other people were there. And they, I think you went last, like out of, you know, it was like one of those sort of round robin workshop things. And Ivan played, and somebody else played, and they're all playing into mics. And, you know, it sounds windy and airy and nice. And then you come out with your thing plugged into a twin and just fucking rip it, right? And it's wicked and it sounds amazing, but it's like 10 times louder than anyone else. And then, like, I was standing backstage watching, you turn to Ivan after that and everyone's going crazy, and you turn to Ivan and you go, "You got to get loud, man."
Well, it did. That was the whole reason for that Aura setup, was to be able to compete with Telecasters, you know, and electric instruments. You know, you know, at a certain point you suffer because you're playing a hollow guitar. You know, they're playing solid wood guitars or that aren't feeding back and going crazy inside, going, "What's this sound? What's that?" And but the Aura gave me the capabilities of playing loud through, you know, because it was going. We first had to invent a bridge pickup that would work, because the dobros have a screen, a screw in the middle, a tension screw for the cone. So to work around that, so we couldn't have one piece going through there. We had to break it down in two pieces and make metal parts, make them, and then find which wood to put on top of that wouldn't be defeating if you wanted to play the guitar acoustically.
Right.
I wanted to be able to play it acoustically and to be able to have the pickup involved. So we went through all these different kinds of wood, you know, the woods that you would think would, "Oh, this will certainly work," you know, some ebony or something to bring back the things that you've lost in the pickup, to bring those things back. And we found out that tusk, it's a man-made wood. But it's like bone, only with fewer imperfections.
Right.
And we put that on top and bam, there it was. It all came back.
Wow. And so that took care of the pickup part. But as far as like the electronics, the modeling part, that's an incredible feat of engineering. Like I have one, and it's like, it solves all my problems of like playing live. 'Cause it's just like, it sounds Wicked.
Yeah, it does. And you can jack it up, and if you're going with, you know, no amp on stage, if you're like, if I'm running ears all the time on stage, I'm playing with, just for instance, I just finished this tour with Tommy Emmanuel, who plays just guitar, and his guitar is plugged. The hole is plugged, and he's got side fills in, and he's got,
it's massive, right?
It's huge. It's like, it's like getting inside his guitar.
Right.
So I go out there and I said, there's no way I can do this without ears and my rig and my Aura rig. And I got no problem. I'm just as loud as him. No problem.
Yep.
Hearing myself or hearing him, it's easy.
So was that a long process getting that to the point where it sounded good? Cause that couldn't have been easy to do.
The Aura boxes were originally a big metal box. I mean, there was a lot packed in there until they finally figured out how to shrink it all down into one pedal, one little pedal. But Larry Fishman actually came to Bill Vorndick's, and we put up we took a whole bunch of Bill's mics, and not all of them at the same time. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And not all at the same time. Like Fishman was doing a thing where they bundle a whole bunch of mics, and then you just play and,
right,
and it would give you it would use that, and we didn't do that. We'd use one mic at a time, and get the Vorndick has an incredible collection of really great microphones, really great vintage Neumanns and 251s, you know, Telefunkens, everything. He's been collecting that stuff for 50 years, and knows how to use it. That's the difference, and
yeah.
But there was I had Larry Fishman there with the app that changed would take I'd play into the microphone and we take the pickup signal at the same time, and then the pickup signal would start emulating the mic sound.
Wow.
And it was just the same way, they matched. And
crazy.
And we did them at different heights. We did it 6 inches, 12 inches, 8 inches, drop D tunings, all these different tunings. And then I had like 100 of these samples to go through. 100, they don't call them samples. They call them whatever they call their samples.
Because it's not, because you're not triggering a sample. That's the amazing thing about the technology is you're not triggering a sound. It's like it's just altering your sound to give it a different.
It's like you're using the microphones, all the different microphones, like you would an EQ. And so we even recorded. They said, well, we need to put an SM57 in there. I went, isn't that what we're trying to get away from? and they said, some people like the sound of it, you know, okay, there are going to be 16 samples, 16 impressions on here. And it's number 16. That's the SM.
That's the 57.
That's the end. Yeah. When all else is gone, SM57 is a microphone made by Shure that you can hammer nails with and then
play
gig with.
Yep. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing.
It is. It's an amazing thing, and it's been around forever. Presidents, you know, everybody all over the world is using the Shure 57 everywhere.
Yeah,
and then at 58 with the ball mic on it. But we did the first microphone in the whole Aura is a U67, which is my favorite recording microphone.
Okay.
And then the third one is an RCA 77, which is nice and warm and
nice ribbon mic.
And nice big ribbon mic, yeah. And that's the one I use on stage the most.
The third one.
And if I need to cut through the band more, I'll go to the 67 number one. And it gives me high end that gets me up over the top of the drums or the whatever is pinging it up there in that zone. And I found those to be my two first go-tos, you know, to try to EQ myself into the band.
Right. Interesting.
That's how I think of those microphones. All those different. You can get the, you know, it comes with a, tells you which each one of those 16, what microphone it is, and at what level we were at, how far away from the guitar we were.
Right.
And I use them more as EQ, and then thinking of them as microphones.
Do you still use a mic on stage or not really?
No.
You don't need to.
If I'm doing a solo show where I'm just kind of got staying in the same place all the time, I'll put a mic up just to catch the ambient sound off the dobro, and that helps. It's a good sound. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why I wanted to play it in the first place. It's the way it sounded.
Yeah.
And I do use a microphone in that situation, and I sing a little bit, so I've got some kind of microphone up there. But mainly I wanted freedom. You know, I wanted to be able to walk around on the stage like an electric guitar player. I didn't want to stand an amp. I didn't want to stand. I mean, there was no amp. I didn't use an amp. And then I could go wireless. I didn't do.
All bets are off.
I did. Yeah. Then you can walk out into the crowd and do it. Yeah. So I'm not too much into that. But I'll step
crowd surfing.
I'll step on the stage during these days anyway. Yeah, the Aura is an amazing advancement. I mean, people keep trying to come up with something else that does it, and there is a it's got a name, and I keep wanting to call it an Oscar, but it's not an Oscar.
Do you mean like the Kemper or something?
Oh, the Kemper is great. I'm into the Kemper, and I'm also into one called a Rev.
It's
got a bunch of different cabinets in it, but that's more for electric lap steels kind.
Yeah.
Because I'm getting out of context here, but the stomp boxes you buy out there on the market are not made for acoustic instruments.
No,
they're made to read an electric guitar or an electric instrument feed. And so I'm really looking for, you know, I'm really like, who can build the best, fuzz box for, you know, or big muff for a dobro?
Yeah.
Do that.
That's what you need.
Because they react differently. You know, they're different, and they change your tone. They do all kinds of crazy things to your tone if you have to go back and fix it later. And they're good to have, because after you play dobro for about 40 years, you kind of want to hear something else.
Yeah, I hear you.
I could get this undobro, you know, go through an envelope filled into a free.
Yeah, a little envelope filter, a little big muff, you'll be.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll be unrecognizable.
Oh, yeah. I've tried to be unrecognizable for a long time now, but I keep coming back to this sound that I love, you know. And
yeah,
I get pretty far away from it once in a while, but then I've got some old dobros in here hanging on the wall that I pull one of them off the wall and sit down, and I'm 10 years old all over again.
Yeah.
All in love.
That's a beautiful thing. Yeah.
But there is something about just the sound of the instrument, just as it is, it's so unique. And you can change it from being unique to just being, you know, like anybody's sound, just by plugging it into something, and then it's all gone. So,
for sure.
What I've been trying to do for years was to create, to be able to make that sound portable, you know, without a microphone being tied to a microphone, being, you know, nailed to the.
I'd say you succeeded. It totally works. It's a crazy piece of equipment.
Yeah,
I think it's brilliant.
It's Bill Borndick and Larry Fishman. Those two guys.
Right on.
They're the ones. And whoever that little fellow in Korea was that came up with.
Hey, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I would be remiss not to ask you about one of my favorite records of all time that you played on. And just see if you had any recollections about the sessions for it, which was Bill Frisell's record Nashville. I've had Bill on the show, and I've also talked to Victor Krause about it. It's kind of one of those records for me that, like, you know, it's a real monument of both of tone, but of playing and composition and everything. And I know you kind of came into that process late, right? Like they did some sessions before you joined, but can you just tell me anything about doing that record and any recollections you have of sort of like figuring out what it was Bill was after?
I was so shaken about going in because I was such a huge Bill Frisell fan. Mm-hmm. I was so shaken by, you know, so excited about going in there to do this session. I forgot my pick bag that day. I tell him, but I had to go to a music store and buy a bar of picks to do the
first really?
Day of the session because, and then ran home and got mine, you know, in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
But I got there and I didn't have a bar, you know. I went,
oh shit.
I got to go to Corner Music, which still was here.
In 12 South, yeah.
Yeah. And
were you guys at Sound Emporium or something? Or where were you doing?
Sound Emporium A. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was playing, you know, and I had the tunes and everything. And they had done some stuff, I think, with this is just when I was joining Allison, because
right.
Ron had smashed his finger, his right index finger in a car door and couldn't play okay. with that finger, but he was playing banjo with his ring finger and his middle finger.
And probably that sounded awesome.
Yeah, different approach. Once in a while, that index finger would hit the string and just make a really sorrowful sound, you know, just forget that.
Ow!
Yeah, and a scream right behind it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, and that's the way he was playing when I joined Acus. He was, the first week or so, he was playing not Ron was always hurting himself, but going in with Bill, and he did a song. I kept noticing. I mean, there was this sound that he was playing, and I said, "Have you ever listened to Chet Atkins with the Everly Brother?" You know, and he said, "Not really."
Really,
this is that sound. This is, you're playing that exact sound. That's what I'm hearing. But he also had a little sampler out in front of him, a little looper that
yep.
could create, you know, all these crazy little ding, bing, bing, bang, bing, bing, bang, bang, bang. They were in no.
It's beautiful.
They were in no order. They were in no timing. They were in no scale or anything like that. They were just like beautiful little sparkly little things, you know, just that the whole track they flow through the whole track.
Yeah.
But they were kind of invisible, but just the songs were, you know, for me it was a different kind of music, because I was there to play jazz. So I was thinking I'm jumping into the jazz pool today.
Mm-hmm.
But it was it was just like the name of the record. You know, he cut it in Nashville and he came there and just kind of soaked up the whole attitude of what was going on around in town and just with the people that he was playing with.
Yeah.
What they were like. He reaches out and grabs pieces of everybody's characteristics and builds his.
Did it come together pretty quickly? Like, as far as the finished product, was it pretty much like you guys walked in
and that
was it?
We were there, I think, 3 days, and taking mm-hmm. it real easy. I mean, I'm not trying to cut a Ralph Stanley three records in one day.
Right.
We were there and doing, you know, two or three songs a day, but really drilling down on them and making sure we liked everything that happened.
Was Bill giving you much input as to what he wanted out of you, or he was just letting you have at her?
Just where to play. That was pretty much it, you know? And I was such a fan and had heard enough of the space that he creates, how to use that space, but not take it away. You know, that was the conundrum. Was to how do you add to this without taking away something? So it was really fun. It really made you think, you know, and really made before you played that note, how's this note going to reflect on what he just played? You know,
right.
You think three notes ahead, you know, and he's such a beautiful guy. I mean, it was all, there are no mistakes, right?
Yeah.
There are no mistakes. They're happy accidents.
Yeah, totally. The last thing I just wanted to ask you about was the recent record you did that's obviously done really well and is up for Grammy now with John Hiatt. And I know you did that at RCA Studio. I was just hoping you could tell me a little bit about those sessions. I mean, it's with your band. It's really acoustic. It's really like a joyful sounding record and sounds beautiful. Can you tell me just about recording in that space and like how the record was done and stuff like that? Have you worked with John before?
Sure. I had worked with John just on a couple of occasions, but you know, he's such an interesting guy. I had kept close, you know, just kept having conversations with him over the years, just stay in contact with him and not knowing if we'd ever play music together at all. It wasn't that kind of thing. I was just interested in him as just a friend and a person. And we didn't see each other that much. We worked together on the Circle B Unbroken record. It was the first time I worked with him.
Oh, he's on that?
He wrote a song and Roseanne Cash sang the song.
Oh.
And but he was there and Roseanne was singing. And we were all, I was sort of in the staff band on that record. It's the longest studio gig I've ever had, you know, for 2 weeks. Just like punch your card and sit down in your seat. And
wow, that went on for a couple of weeks, eh?
Yeah, every day.
Amazing.
Like, wow, okay, John Denver's here. John Denver and Johnny Cash are here today. Oh, great. Okay. Oh, them. Somebody asked me if I'd ever recorded with John Johnny Cash and who was the other guy? Oh, John Denver. No, I don't think so. And they said, yeah, you did. Why'd you ask me?
Was that record done at RCA too?
No, that one was done at Scrub Sound. That was long.
Oh, okay.
Scruggs, Randy Scruggs had a studio. But RCA B is a tricky place. I mean, they've got an X on the floor where Elvis would stand singing. It's way in the back of the room.
Really?
But somebody, I've heard that when Chet Atkins first went into that room, and that was going to be his workshop, you know?
Yeah.
He cut so many. That's where all the gigantic ancient songs that we all write songs from now. Well, that's where all that stuff was cut. And it's got a tile floor, tile floor, which is hard as a rock. And then it's got this acoustic tile everywhere. But that wasn't enough to make the room not go bing bong everywhere. And so the first engineer they had in there, Chet, fired him and got this guy in who walked around the room and said, the room here, we can make the room sound less bright. We can, you know, we kind of treated the ceiling a little bit, but not much. But they had big arms that would swing out from the wall and they could put these big deca trees on there, you know, put three 250s, you know, these big old cars, these big old Neumann
two condensers. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, just beautiful microphones and have three of those hanging over the string section. They put the string section there and they just roll out this thing and there they go. You know, they were set up for the Nashville sound. And that's all the records came out and sounded kind of the same after a while. But not those first Everly Brothers records and all that stuff. You know, that stuff.
Those were done there, too.
Those were done there, too. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
So this was right in the top of COVID, too. So we were originally going to have to break down and set up every day because of tours. And
you want to do that?
Thank God COVID hit.
Yeah, yeah.
Stop the tours. So we had an indefinite stretch of just getting in there and setting up and leaving it set up. Baffles, you know, everything we want.
How long did you stay set? How long was the whole record?
4 days. 4 days. 4 days cutting. 4 days cutting, probably five, yeah, 6 days mixing. I take longer to mix than I do to cut, to record, because I like.
Do you get involved? Like, are you a technical guy? Do you get involved in the mixing stuff, or are you just?
Yeah.
I'm
always throwing ideas, but I love having a great engineer. You know?
Yeah.
I need a great engineer. Born Dick.
Who engineered that record?
Sean Sullivan. Don Sullivan did. And
yeah, that guy knows what he's doing.
Yeah. And, you know, he's doing all kinds of records, and he was working in a, you know, over at the butcher shop over there at
first. He's mostly at Cowboy Arms now, right?
Yeah, I think so. And Mark, yeah. And Mark, that used to have a studio over in 12 South. Mark's got one over. He bought Grandpa Jones' old farm and turned the tractor shed into a studio. So now there's one.
Really?
There. Yeah, it's great.
Where's that? What part of town is that?
That's in Springfield. That's up north, close to Kentucky, Kentucky line. It's really close to where, String Beans' place was.
Okay.
All that tragedy.
Wow, Grandpa Jones and String Bean lived close by?
They did. Actually, Grandpa found them. He found them. He was going to go with them that morning, and he found their bodies. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, tragedy. But Mark's got the place over there now, and he's working on it. And RCAB, we kind of – it had a brand new small Neve console, mm-hmm, that was great because we didn't need buku channels, you know, we're recording to Pro Tools but we all kind of got, I walked around in the room and Sean did too, and we just kind of found out places where we could put each other that were socially distanced from each other. And we wore masks all the time until you got to your station where to your microphone. You, while you're by yourself there, take your mask off. But as soon as you...
Oh, so you guys were positioning yourselves far enough away to be like COVID safe. Wow.
Yeah.
That's kind of weird.
We were going, we had to go by COVID rules. And we did it because we just didn't want to, nobody wanted to be sick. And this was during the really... This was before Delta, you know, when the big one came through. And we all escaped. We all, but you know, we were safe. We were in there together. No one had it. We tested once in a while, but everything was fine.
So you were probably on headphones then to be able to hear stuff.
We are
properly. Yeah.
We were on headphones because we did have baffles up, so to prevent some bleed. The Dobro was and the vocal and the guitar were going down at the same time. So there was no repairing that.
Right.
But we just did takes. Like three or four takes of each song. And I did some
full band playing live.
Full band all the way.
Yeah.
And no drum. Right. He didn't want, when we first were talking about this, he said, I'd like to do it without drums. He said, I'd like to do it kind of raw. And I said, that's fine. We have a great drummer in our band, but, you know, he'll sit out and we all come from a bluegrass background where if we hear a place for rhythm, one of us will do it. We'll do it.
Yeah.
It's needed somewhere. It's going to happen. Yeah. So it did. I mean, Lily Hyatt came in one day and she said, who's playing drums? And I said, there's no drums. She said, there's drums. And I said, no, there are no drums. You know, between the bass, the bass and me chopping or
it's all covered.
Also, the fiddle chopping and Christian played so much great stuff on that record.
He's killer on that record, man. He's great. Yeah.
There's some little hidden stuff. There's stuff floating around that I didn't even know he did it until I was mixing, until I was really able to zero in on everybody.
Yeah.
That little Neve console did a great job.
Were there any issues that you came across when you were in the mixing process, like as far as how the room affected the ensemble? Like, was there any weirdness that?
Yeah, definitely. That room has a sound and you cannot take it off. And
right.
So you use it. You use it.
Yeah.
You know, you.
It sounds amazing. Like, it sounds like a certain space. You know, I don't know the room because I've only been through it like on a tour or whatever, but I can imagine that it, you know, it,
and
that
it
record is a pretty good.
To be in there at night, you know?
Yeah.
Because there's no one
really
out, and you're in the studio that you know that, you know, everybody's dead, but they're still there. They're going, you shouldn't play that note right there. Yeah, don't do that. Yeah. But yeah, it was kind of creepy to be in there late at night. We kind of knock off when it got dark, and then
yeah.
But we were all sort of down in the area, in the part of the room, in the bottom of the room, sort of closer to the control room. Mm-hmm. And John was sitting where we could all see John because we're all queuing from John, and then next to him. Christian was over here. Fiddle was, Christian was over here. Electric guitar was here. And I was sort of between electric and the bass.
Yeah.
But I could have done it without phones. I could have, but it was just better hearing the whole thing, hearing the sounds.
Yeah.
But the room has a sound of its own. Like the studios around town that I can hear on a record, I can tell where that part of it was cut anyway.
Right.
You know, a drum.
That's cool.
And you want a certain drum sound, you go over to there's a place over on Iris over in Berry Hill. There's a place that if drums are cut in there, they have this sound. Mm. And RCA has a sound. It's tile floor. You can't get away from it.
Right.
You put as many carpets down as you want to, but
it's still there.
We just did. We didn't even try to defeat the room.
Was John just pulling out new songs, or was it like, had you guys rehearsed and arranged the music before you went in?
Well, John, as it turned out, had just moved before we started this record. He had just moved into my neighborhood, and it's sort of a musical neighborhood. It's in West Mead, and John lives less than a mile from me. So I would go over to John's, and we'd go through songs, and he sent me a bunch of songs, and when he sent me, you know, Burning Sun, that hit me so hard. I said, "Is this real?" And he said, "Yeah, that's what happened. That's my brother. That's what happened."
Wow.
And all his songs are sort of autobiographical. Even Mississippi Phone Booth. He'd explain them to me, and I'd take them home and just kind of like lay all that out and try. I was even at that point thinking about what order this stuff goes in. You know, looking at a bigger picture so I could kind of move on and have that done.
Yeah.
You know? So I did that. I knew that Light of the Burning Sun was not going to start the record or end it. But what was going to kick right off the top and how we end this thing, you know, what's this journey, you know, what's this wave that records, if you still listen to a record from the beginning.
I do.
Most people don't, you know. Most people pick it, you know, they buy. They don't buy all record anymore, but I do. I buy them and listen to them because I want to see what else is there, not just the hit.
I'm with you, man.
I want to see what made the hit so good.
yeah.
So we would study those things, and I'd say three or four trips over to his house and studying what he gave me and trying to figure out how my band could do this. I knew that my band could do this and could make the sound. We'd have a uniform sound. We're planning a tour. No brainer. Let's go this route. I've got all the faith in the world in the guys that are playing with me that they can make
things. Totally.
And it turned out great. And it's done all this. It's up for a Grammy. We did a video, a documentary thing, and that won a film festival the other day. So we got all.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. I haven't heard about that. Cool.
Yeah. We got a bunch of stuff going on.
Yeah. Right on. And you're doing some more touring with him, or are you kind of done with that for now?
Well, that's sort of out there. It's still out there as a possibility. And, so we started in August, and Daniel, bass player, got COVID the first day of rehearsals. So we did the first three. So we did the first three gigs with no bass.
Oh man.
Oh man. That was weird. We're so glad to get him back. And
yeah, he's pretty good. That guy. Eh?
Yeah.
Love him. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the way it started. But then we came home. We finally finished that tour the day before Thanksgiving. So I was home Thanksgiving, and then I jumped on the Bayless Bluegrass
Heart. Right, the Bluegrass Heart
the
stuff.
The day after Thanksgiving.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's a bit of a shift.
It was a big shift. It was a big shift, and I finished up with Bayla like at Carnegie Hall on the 9th or 10th. Of January, and then I went to Scotland for transatlantic sessions, and I've been,
man,
this is like my third day home.
Amazing.
So, you know,
you're not slowing down anytime soon.
Reentry. No, there's plenty to do. There's plenty to, I had to cancel a couple of things. I knew I wasn't going to be able to do the Little Feet show. And there's a series called George and Tammy that's going to be out later.
Yeah, I know all about that. Yeah,
that's gonna be great. I went in and did all of old Bashful Brothers, all Oswald's.
Oh, well, that's cool.
And I was gonna go down, and they're filming now in Wilmington, but I just I couldn't do it, man. I'm too tired to go down there and do that. But somebody's faking dope my dobro parts today. So
yeah, that's good. Yeah, I'm buddies with Jay Bellero, so he told me about those sessions happening.
Yeah,
you know, for the soundtrack for it anyway.
Yeah, we've been working with
T-Bone. That's wicked, man.
We're back with T-Bone's back, and
yeah.
So we've been working on that, and that's going to be good. Michael Shannon and all. Yeah, it's going to be, they're great actors in it. It ought to be.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see it.
It's, what's her head playing, Tammy, God, what's her name?
Yeah. I can't remember who's playing it, but it's somebody good. Somebody really good.
Yeah.
I remember it.
Well, Jerry, thanks, man. I could talk to you all day, but I'll let you run here. And, thank you so much for talking to me and
oh, sure, man.
Setting this up, man. I really appreciate it. Hope to see you one of these days around town. And,
yeah.
It's just a real treat to talk to you. I'm such a fan.
I'm going to be around. Oh, thanks. I'm going to be around a while. I've got some stuff to do. Allison's making noise again. So, so we're going to be working, sort of experimenting around a little bit with Acus, but see what
Union Station 2.0.
Yeah. I said, hey, this could be a reunion tour at this point.
Yeah. Or do a farewell tour.
Don't we make more money that way? Yeah.
Totally.
One time, Tim O'Brien's mother, he said something about Bob Dylan playing in town. She said, didn't they break up? He said, yeah, they're getting back together. Reunion tours pay more.
Yeah, man. I think Kiss is doing their 12th final show this year.
Those poor guys, man. We Acus, we opened up for Kiss in Oslo one time.
What?
We opened up for Kiss and we took a picture with them. And during the picture, what's his name's the bass players?
Gene Simmons.
One of these big thorns on his shoulder hit Barry right in the corner of the eye. And we were threatening to sue Kiss for a while. We watched his eye change different colors, you know, every day. We were on a tour in Europe, and it was one of the best tours I've ever been on. But yeah, we ended up somehow opening up in Oslo for Kiss.
What band that you were in opened for Kiss?
Acus.
Holy shit! That's funny, man. Wow, I would love to see that.
Oh well.
It you didn't sit in, I guess.
Crazy, man. There's all these people standing in the rain, in the mud, with their Kiss makeup on, singing every word to every Alison Krauss song we did. It was nuts.
So wow.
It was it's a good memory.
Life is full of crazy stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
You got a few stories, man.
I'll write a book someday. Good to see you.
Thanks, Jerry.
Take it easy.
You too. All right, that was my conversation with Jerry Douglas. Thus endeth season 6 of the podcast. Thank you so much for listening and supporting the show. I really appreciate you all. And we'll see you in a couple months for another chilling rendition of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. We'll see you then. Music Makers and Soul Shakers is produced at the Hen House Studio in Nashville, Tennessee by Steve Dawson. Please remember to subscribe to the show and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. You can find more info on this episode, including show notes and an audio playlist at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Thanks again to our amazing sponsors this season, Ear Trumpet Labs, Union Tube and Transistor, Black Mountain Picks, Isotope, and Spectra 1964. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.